Welcome to Veterans Voices UK, the podcast sharing the stories of British military veterans from across the generations. In each episode, you'll hear from those who've served, from the Second World War to those of more recent conflicts. But these aren't just war stories, they're stories of life, of friendship and resilience, and the lasting impact of service. I'm Matt Liam, and today I'm honoured to introduce Pete Cook, recorded just weeks after his 100th birthday. Pete tells us about his early life on the family farm in Bedfordshire and how everything changed when he left home to join the Royal Navy during the Second World War. He shares his memories of VE Day and helping take the surrender of German U-boats in the Irish Sea. Then, with the war in Europe over, he sailed to the Far East, where he now witnessed the surrender of Japanese forces on remote islands. So let's hear from Pete Cook, as he begins by telling us about the family farm, where he still lives today.
My parents came from Devon, Chagford on the Moor, and there were farmers down there. But my father was quite young when they came up here. And he bought a couple of farms up here, small farms, which over the years expanded in acreage, so we had a little bit more to go. In the end, he had three farms. He farmed them. He and his father farmed them, and they kept a few cattle and a little bit of corn because it was hard work getting the corn.
Am I right in thinking that your father was a particular horseman? He was a good horse rider.
My father was a cavalryman.
And did he serve in the cavalry during World War?
He served in the Bedson Hart.
Yeomanry. Yeah.
Base Yeomanry.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a big horseman. He got his own hunter. He rode every day.
And what about your mother? What kind of a lady was your mum?
Very, very small. My father was 6'1½", and my mother was about 5 feet. She was very small, very dainty, liked to be in all the things, the Mother's Union, all these type of things. She'd always go into those. And she brought us three kids up during hard times.
So you were born in 1925, so sort of only a matter of a few years after the end of World War One. In your very young days there, almost probably before you started school, was there a knock-on effect of World War One as you were growing up in that sort of mid-1920s?
Not really. My father never spoke a lot about it. But I used to learn more from some of the old boys in the village who were in the same regiment that he was in New France.
And I'm going to leave, I know we've chatted before about this, that your father was actually, you understand he was commissioned in the field in Belgium during one of the battles.
He was commissioned in at Ypres. I didn't know that until about 4 years ago when my neighbour said, "Would you like to read this?" And he gave a few lines of where and when he received that award.
Brothers and sisters in those early days? An older sister, I believe?
I had an older sister, very, very learned girl. I had a younger brother who was 5 years younger, and he was spoiled because he had some sort of children's illness.
But what about those early days of growing up on the farm? I mean, were they exciting days, your early days leading up and starting school? I mean, where was the school that you started, Pete?
The school was in the village. It was a local village school. You went there until you went to Bedford Model School. That's where I went. I went there when I must have been 11. I hated school, like a lot more. But now I got through, and then I went straight onto the farm when I was 15 and worked there until I was put my name on a piece of paper to go away.
Yeah. And And I mean, you spoke a couple of times about the farm and about the village. And am I right in thinking you've lived your entire life in this little small village that we're in today?
Within 100 yards of my birth spot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were born in the house over there.
So you were born in the house over there. And am I right in thinking that this was one of the barns as you grow that we're sat in now? It was one of the barns in those days.
This barn can tell a lot of stories. We're now sitting in one of the old pigsties. Adjacent to that was where the horse feed came, the chaff, and all that sort of stuff. And then you had the stable next to that. On the piece that adjacent to it running was the dairy where the cows were milked by hand on a three-legged stool. Yeah, we milked in there. I think we milked 20 cows in the end, all by hand. And we had some very, very lovely Lanarkshire girls, which I taught to milk. Very nice days. And then I sort of joined up, and when my age came right, I said, enough's enough. I want to go. And I went.
But you wouldn't, if I'm right, Pete, working on a farm, so, you know, now with the outbreak of World War II, you wouldn't have actually had to be called up. You know, you would...
No.
You'd be in a protected trade as a farmer, weren't you?
I was, and so I couldn't go, you see, for a start. He said, you were in a reserve occupation. I said, no, that finished yesterday. I want to go in the forces. I want to join the Navy.
So how did you come to join up then? What was the story about you actually, you know, making the decision that you were going to join?
Yeah, I'd lost three mates in the village. One of them was a POW in Japan. And I thought, no, I've got to go. So I made my way to the Dover and St. James Halls in Northampton. And I saw where it said recruiting office, and I walked up there. And I've never seen such a big man in all my life. And he said, what do you want, Sonny? I said, I want to join the Navy. Well, I hadn't got any clue. I didn't know what the Navy was and what the Marines were. So he said, you wait a minute. And he sent me with an escort back home. But I was here again the next day. You back again, Sonny? He said, that's degrading. Because Sonny, and I want to defend the country. And within a few weeks, I was in. My birthday was on the 30th of October, and I had my corps up. I'd spoken to them before my birthday came up, and I think I had about 6 weeks to go. And I'd never been on a train before, and I had to go from here to London, then to Portsmouth. By myself, but there was the railway facilities that you couldn't get lost in those days.
So it was goodbye to the farm there. I mean, really, to that point of...
Oh, yeah.
And saying goodbye. So did Mum and Dad come down to the station and wave you?
No fear.
Yeah?
No way. Life changes, and it changes very, very quickly. And I met some very good friends. I lost some good friends.
So we jump on a train, we get down to Portsmouth for our basic training. You know, can you remember that first couple of days of arriving? What was that like compared to the rural life of Bedfordshire and living on a farm all of your life?
Well, the first meal we had was breakfast, and it's what they called yellow peril, and I hate it. And I thought, oh, I don't know. I've just joined up to eat this. Anyway, I got through, and I pushed my way through because I'd got a lot of experiences that the other lads hadn't got.
So what date would this be, Peter? When would this would be? This would be what? January, February? 44? Yeah.
End of 43 I went in.
So late 43, you actually...
Late 43,
so,
yes.
So we're talking about the winter of 1943-44.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Because I went to Collingwood first, the naval base down there, and
So in your basic training, there was a period there that Portsmouth was bombed quite heavily, wasn't it? Do you remember that at all?
I do very well. The air raid shelters were in threes. There's one, two, three. And they were only about 100 yards from the huts. And they came over and bombed it about the fourth or fifth day I was there. Took two of them out with the occupants. That was my initial entrance to the Royal Navy. I never regretted the day I joined. It was the best education you could have. Never regretted it.
So basic training out the way. Where did you go after your basic training? I believe you were selected. I don't know whether it was your choice, but you went on to the gunnery side.
I went to Whale Island Gunnery School, supposed to be the best in the country, and I was second there. They were good. Very, very strict. Frightened me to death. So I got out of that one quite well because I could do a lot of things that the lads were called up couldn't do. Going over rigging, I mean, they're going to say over the rigging, oh, I'm down the other side before the others got a grip on it. I was very, very manual, trying to death sometimes. No, very manual. There ain't nothing I couldn't do.
So, Pete, I mean, Whale Island is very local to Portsmouth, isn't it? So,
oh, yes.
So you did your basic training there at Collingwood. You did your gunnery school piece at on Whale Island.
Yes.
Where did you go after that?
Well, I went to Scotland.
What were you doing in Scotland?
I went up there, the commando training base, ready to go on LCPLs, landing craft personnel. That is where I met King Haakon of Norway. Like an ordinary little man like her, like the rest of us. Yeah, he was nice though. Very civil. Spoke to me. He spoke very good English. I only saw him for perhaps a quarter of an hour, going over and then getting him off the boat.
So this was his visit to HMS Quebec then?
It was, yes.
Yeah. Yes. And so you were posted to Quebec?
I was posted to Quebec.
Yeah. Did you enjoy Quebec?
Yes and no. The weather would mess things though. It's horrible. But no, it was hard work and I expected it. And I couldn't understand why I was so fit. Yeah, I learned a lot at Quebec. Yeah. I didn't realise what it was until I heard the mills in the morning. And I thought, what are they? What's those noises? Didn't register at all. And somebody said, they're about to feed the mules. And I said, well, what are they feeding? What mule? This is what they train with mules to go to France. Oh, I thought, oh dear. So I didn't ask too many questions after that. You learn a lot looking at other people doing things. And that was Quebec.
HMS Quebec, I mean, landing craft, one of the Royal Marines, or the commando training bases,
yeah.
Really in preparation for D-Day.
It was.
Must have been a really busy time.
It was very, very busy.
What about days off? Did you actually get away at all and manage to get out for a day at all?
The chief would come and say, anybody want to run ashore? Yes, please, sir. And sometimes we're only away a couple of hours, but it was a break. But that is when I found this lovely old lady, and her husband was a small farmer. He used to kill his own deer and hang those up in the cold store outside. And I met a very good friend.
We know that HMS Quebec was, as we've said, a commando training centre, really for the landing craft side of which we...
That's right, yes.
So much of this must be in preparation for D-Day, for the 6th of June.
Yes.
Can you remember that being announced?
Yes, I do. It was, I can't remember, it was just before dusk. They told us to be prepared. And it was the first landings were going in then, on the evening of the day, of that day. I can't remember which day it was now, but Yeah, that's when I first knew that something big was happening.
And what was the knock-on effect in the next few days?
Not good. I saw things I'd never seen before. But you override it, you just take as it comes.
You say you saw things you've never seen before. Were these casualties?
Casualties coming back.
And they were brought back up?
They were brought back. Only minor casualties. No, they were walking casualties.
Yeah.
Yeah, they weren't ambulance from here and all. They were walking casualties. Yeah, which was bad enough.
So the summer of 1944, Pete, it sees you moving again, if I'm right. You leave HMS Quebec and you get your first draft on board a ship, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. And it was one of the lock class.
The lock class.
Yeah. Can you remember when you were told about that? How were you told that you were leaving Quebec? And remember the sort of the departing of Quebec?
Yeah. The duty officer came up and said that there was, I think there were 10 of us. You were leaving Quebec and you were during the Quoich. And up a man, I said, what is the Quoich? You'll find out. Oh dear. And I did.
But you joined the Quoich right at the very beginning, almost
yes.
At the sea trials level, didn't you?
She hadn't done sea trials when we joined her. No.
What were the sea trials like?
A laugh. Because it's one of the things that always stick in your mind. We just pulled up and then we went speed trial or something. And then the old man said, anchors away. And there were. The stoker came down with his big hammer, hit the clasp. That's the end of the cable.
So when it had been
built.
So when they'd built it, they'd not tied the end of the cable of the anchor.
Yeah, they hadn't fixed it in the bilges. Well, I couldn't help but laugh. He said, you stop that laughing. But it was retrieved because it wasn't in all that deep water. They had it, we hadn't got an anchor for about 3 days or so. And sent the divers down to pick it up. Funny little things like that stick in your mind and make a day of it, don't they?
I mean, sea trial's over. Did you then join one of the escort groups?
Sorry?
Did you join one of the escort groups after
yes.
the sea trials? Yeah, can you remember?
Frightened me to death for a start. I saw all these, I thought they were merchant ships, but they were troopers. And we were supposed to take them from Gibraltar, Greenock, to Gibraltar. Well, I thought this looked simple, but it wasn't. You put in a lot of hours. Yeah, but we got through and never heard of, didn't have any trouble at all. It's some years I learned that I should never learn again. It's brilliant. And the things that happen is...
So, I mean, by the time you'd done the sea trials and you'd done that first escort group, it must have been getting on towards VE Day, Victory Day.
It was. Yes, it was.
I mean, that of all the veterans I've chatted with, one of the great days that they remember in their service is VE Day, you know, end of the war in Europe.
That's right, yeah.
Remember VE Day? You were still on the Quoich?
I was on the Quoich, yeah.
Can you remember... Do you remember the day?
I do, because the old man said he wanted to make an announcement and he wanted everybody there splice the main brace, which we did. Yeah, it all went quiet. We all had a drink and saluted the old man and thanked him. And then, of course, that was it. Everything went quiet. There was no... No escorts coming in or going out for anything. It sort of, it calmed the sea because it was bloody rough on one or two occasions. But we got through.
Yeah. But what about the German U-boats that you've been tracking over that period? You know.
Well, the first thing we knew about those came from Admiral Donets, chief of the German Navy.
Yeah, he was almost running Germany at one stage.
He was.
Yeah.
Yeah, very clever man. He announced that all German U-boats were to surface, muzzle covers on, and flying the black flag. And there were three in our area, which we hadn't located, all within half a mile. But they came up and they went stem to stern, tied up stem to stern, and we had to supply a decking crew. And there was an officer, a chief petty officer, a petty officer, and two raiders with firearms. And we went on board just like that. No problems whatsoever. And they were damn glad to see us.
So you actually went on board and...
I boarded one of them.
And you were one of the ratings who took the surrender of one of the U-boats.
Yes.
What was the interaction with the German submariners on there?
They were all very pleased to see us. I mean, the captain spoke perfect English, as they would. I was very, very lucky. Yeah.
And can you remember what happened? You know, once the surrender was taken, you, as you said, the three of them were tied stem to stern. Can you remember what happened after that?
Well, they went into the Foyle River.
Oh, going down towards Londonderry.
Down towards Londonderry, you got it, yeah. And when they were tied, if I remember correctly, it was about 40 of them.
For many, VE Day, you know, was seen as almost the end of the war. It was the end of the war in Europe, but as you know, VJ Day was many months away.
It was, yeah.
Am I right in thinking that almost immediately after VE Day, you sailed for the Far East?
We did. Yeah, we weren't originally told we were going to the Far East, but I had 4 days leave and came back and said, get your kit bag made up. A lot of new things came on board. We had four more Oricons fitted.
This is the heavy gun, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, yeah, reasonably heavy.
Yeah.
Well, we'd already got two, and we had four more fitted on forecastle. Yeah, we had those fitted. I think it was the second day after I came back from my leave that they said, get ready for leaving port. This was in Derry. And they didn't tell us where we were going, never said a word. And nobody answered any questions. But we'd been out for some time. This isn't familiar country. Canal, the Suez, entrance to the Suez. I thought we'd getting farther away from home. Anyway, we got into the Suez and we got as far as Aden. I thought, it looks a bit dark around here. And it was smoke. And there was an oil tanker on fire in Aden Dockyard. I don't know, for what cause, I don't know. But anyway, we weren't allowed to go ashore and look at it. And we got through the Suez and I thought, we're still not going right. And then he told us, he said, men be prepared. You will not be going home on weekend leave this time. We went to Colombo. That was our home port, Colombo. Lovely place. I think we stayed there for 2 days.
Colombo was home port, for the second part of it. I think this is a period where we thought we may have to actually invade Japan to finish the war, wasn't it?
Yes, there was.
A period of time.
Yes.
So you must have, going across there, you must have crossed the equator at one time.
Yes, we did.
Did you have a crossing?
Yeah, a good day.
Did you have a crossing the line so early?
Of course, I've given most of my things away. I've got a thing of it. Yeah, crossing the line.
So after the crossing the line ceremony, I mean...
That was brilliant.
Yeah.
I forget where it was now. We did it.
I mean, who was there the day you celebrated it? I remember you spoke to me when we worked our way through the book about Malcolm Jefferson. Was he with you at that time?
I believe he must have been. Oh, he was the one that was used to ride my aunt's horses. Yes, Malcolm Jefferson, yes. He rode my aunt's horses down in Henley and Arden. And do you know, we were great pals after that. I couldn't go wrong. Lovely man. And he was with us for some time. And the last time I met him was in Birmingham. Yeah, that was good crossing the line. And Malcolm was there. And he became a good friend on board. He didn't treat me as a rating. He treated me as a friend. If he was going out anywhere, Cookie, get your clothes on. And he took me out. Lovely man.
So really, I mean, the Coit was also involved in sailing around a number of the islands, taking a surrender. I mean,
we were, yes, we were.
We humorously joke about Japanese snipers being out there for ages after. But there was a lot of the islands didn't know that
they didn't know the war was over.
Yeah, and you had a Japanese officer on board.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, can you remember him?
I can very well. He spoke perfectly. He's quite a good-looking guy. He went to school in England. A very nice guy.
And what was it like when you went on board, went ashore on some of the islands? I mean, with him, what did you?
Well, you had to be careful because you weren't quite sure who was what. I mean, they could be islanders. They could have come from another island because a lot of trading went on, small trading with food and other things. So you had to be very careful how you approached, but most were glad to see us because they'd had enough of it.
Well, as you went from island to island, did you actually come across small Japanese garrisons at all?
Oh, yes. Yes, there were several of them. Well, one of them was quite a big, there was a garrison of them, but they had only just heard that the war was over because their wireless mast had all been smashed. And they've got no communication.
And what was the, you know, as you sort of said hello to them, what was the greeting like? What was that moment like when?
Well, when they realised who we were and what we could do, every time you came up to one, he said to attention. Very polite. One or two of them were a little bit, you know, we've got to show an upper hand. But otherwise, they weren't too bad.
Am I right, Pete, in thinking that on Quoik, the only real action you had was in the Far East, and it was a merchant vessel that had been seized by rebels.
That is correct.
And it was a real uncomfortable thing about the, you know, that shadowed peace that, you know, soon after VJ Day or around VJ Day, and Quoik was sent to attack it.
Yes. She came from Nagoya, and she was running down to Penang. And she was mostly carrying food and I don't know what else. There was definitely food being carried down, but she got a lot of Japanese on board, and we took them off it. We had a job to sink it. It made a fool looking at us. Give it a few 4 inches and see how to go. Well, I was going to screw. I couldn't get. I think I had 4 or 5 high explosives went into her. And then our acoustics man who used to do all the depth charges, and he asked permission to see the officer. And then we pulled up alongside him. And he said, what do you want, Sonny? And he said, permission to put 2 depth charges. And if I'm right, I can get them through the damage that's been on the day. And he granted it. And we had the CNC of the Dutch East Indies on board to witness the sinking of it in case it got diverted to go into another area. He gave permission to sink it. And he went down within 3 or 4 minutes. And he missed the actual sinking because he was drinking with the officer on board. But it just folded up.
That was the only real action, you know. I mean, we had the E-Day, you know, boarding the U-boat.
Yeah.
The only action of firing the guns on a Quoik was to take this troublesome merchant boat out.
It was.
Yeah.
We were lucky.
Yeah.
Because we did numerous convoys. We're doing it from Greenock down to Ireland, and we were lucky.
The Middle East is well known. I mean, there was a lot of people, and the medicines weren't what they were now. Did you ever suffer from malaria when you was in the in the Far East at all, Peter?
Did I have malaria? I had it for 22 years, and I don't want it again. And it stopped just like that. Yeah, I first went to a rest camp in just outside of Bombay the first time I went, and it was run by a Dutch nurse. And she was a care without a tail, she was. Terrible woman. She used to turn up in the mornings and I don't think it was a Rolls Royce, but it was a big, big car with a chauffeur. Did she come in? Look how you were, so you were all dirt. But no, I had it for 22 years. And you know, it stopped just like that. Really bad. Yeah, the kids would tell you. We used to go to Cornwall quite a lot on holiday. And I used to smoke heavily. And I used to light one cigarette when I left home and didn't rely on no one to go there. And by the time I got to Buckingham, I was sitting over there and the water would be running off my nose. I used to lost stones on it. But and then it just stopped just like that. But 22 years I had of it.
You when we chatted about the book, which is, believe it or not, 4 years ago now, you told me about a subterranean volcano.
Oh God, yeah.
You witnessed.
We was, I don't know whether it was, I don't quite know which end of the line that we were operating on, because we had a lot of islands and we had to go to everyone to take the surrender. But this one, golly, we must have been half an mile out when I saw this water spout. Oh, that looks a bit dodgy. And then the whole place erupted. The sea was rough. And I mean rough. And we couldn't, we must have been, yeah, we were half a mile away from it.
And the island just disappeared?
The island just sort of went like folded and went down. But the things that were floating around afterwards, oh, nothing alive.
Yeah. And how big an island was it? I mean, was it, you know, was it got a sort of small quayside and port, or was it more?
Well, sitting here, I can't honestly remember, but I think we were more or less midships, and you could see both ends.
Yeah,
400 or 500 yards long.
Yeah,
yeah, but not all that wide.
Yeah,
but it got everything on it, everything, pigs, animals, no pretty sight.
Yeah. And another story, if I may, Pete, remind you of, was you were, I think you were moored off an island, and the chief came out with a pig to thank you.
We saw this boat coming out, and the aero's spotter, he said, there's a boat just left the bank, and he's coming towards us, action stations. He didn't know what was in it. We didn't know until he was, 100 yards away. And he held this pig up, and apparently he was headman of one of the, I can't remember the name of the island, but he was bringing it as a goodwill mission for getting the Japs off his island. The old man said, Cookie, a job for you. Oh, God, here we are. And doing, I do love pig's liver. He never had a bit of it. He ate a lot. It wasn't a very big pig, it was only. That was one of the days I was very sad, having to live. The captain had all the liver.
You know, your days in the Navy came to an end while you were still in the Far East. After,
yes.
After VJ Day.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, can you remember the day you were told that, you know, your days in the Navy are
coming? I was standing by the gateway to India in Bombay. He came up and stood beside me. He said, you're going home, Cookie. And I said, you can tell that to the Marines. He said, you are. You're on the list to go home, but you've got to make your own way. Well, it was a bit frightening, really. I thought, I might take the wrong direction. I actually came home on the Katrine, his sister ship to us. She always carried the senior officer.
And that was all the way back into
Portsmouth? All the way back into Portsmouth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what happened when you got into Portsmouth? You know, I mean, you now know that you're days away from getting back to the farm. What happened in them final days in the Navy?
I don't think I went to bed that night. I don't think I did. Duty sergeant, got there with his clipboard. Although he's not going to call my name out, but he's in the end. When? Tomorrow. And tomorrow I was on my way home. As quickly as that. Couldn't thank him enough. But after about a week, I wanted to go back.
But when you got into Portsmouth, am I right in thinking that didn't go as smoothly as you'd hoped?
No, not for a start.
Yeah.
No. No, it didn't go. No, there were some ifs and buts. I think I was on board her 24 hours longer than I should have been. We got back.
Yeah.
That's the main thing.
And then back to the farm.
Yes.
And, you know, we've been away. We've been to war. We've seen more of the world than anybody in the village has probably ever seen in their life.
Absolutely.
And then you drift back to the farm. What was it like picking up when you got back to the farm, you know?
I couldn't do anything for about a week. What are you going to do when you're working? Here we go. He was a slave driver. I started work. I think the first thing I had was to break some young horses in. That wasn't too strenuous for me. Because you'd be surprised how your body changes. I mean, from doing hard work, and horse work was hard work, sitting on the upper deck, just looking, it comes a bit of a shock. But here I am.
This is 1946, 47?
Yes, 46.
47. We're now in 2025, so it's sort of coming up for 80 years.
I wasn't an old man when I left. And I was married. You see, you couldn't get, my parents were very religious, and you were not allowed to get married until you were 21. I came home in the, but it was somewhere about the August time. Joan and I had been together all the time, and I announced that I was going to get married to my parents. It didn't go down very well.
And the two of you, I mean, you got married, you in turn had your own children and a family, and
yeah.
And, you know, you carried on the farm and took over from mum and dad and you ran it. And
yeah, still, I did.
You ran the farm and you were still working on the farm well into your 80s.
Yes, I would be 80, yeah.
Yeah.
No, not quite.
Yeah.
No, because I said I was going to retire at 60. But I should have done. I should have been better off than I am now.
So the two of you were married and carried on running the farm here.
Yes.
And really, you were very much the centre of village life here. You know, for 75 years you were together. And you sadly lost her. And, you know, you now live on your own here in you know.
We used to go abroad quite a bit on holiday. About twice a year I'd go somewhere. The first place I ever went to was Sri Lanka. And that's, I love that place.
Yeah.
You been there?
No.
Oh, it's lovely. Now, I must say, I've had a good life. Some things I wouldn't do again, but I've had a good life.
Yeah. I probably should just explain to anybody listening to the podcast today that many people will know, I first met you 4 years ago when we chatted for the book about World War II veterans. And you kindly invited me to your 100th birthday party last year. And it was at that I said, would you be happy to do a podcast for me? And it's the first opportunity we've had it.
Yeah.
I mean, 100 years old, Pete, can I ask you, I mean, That's a century of life. What has been the highlights for you in those 100 years? Moments that you remember probably more clear than others?
Joining the Navy and coming home.
Why joining the Navy? What was, you know, you virtually ran away from home to go and join the Navy.
Yeah, I ran away from home.
Why was it such a highlight?
Well, all my friends had gone in the village. One or two of them had left for...
You know, I mean, in some ways, I mean, if we take the story, you know, you were born in 1925. You haven't drifted far from the village other than for your time in the Royal Navy.
No, I haven't. We used to try and go abroad somewhere different twice a year. I used to take Joni. And no, I don't think I have. Yeah. No, I've never been one for, oh, well, let's go to Scotland tonight. And no, I've never been the one for lots of travel because I consider I've seen all I want to see.
I was once told that that people joining the forces, whether they go as an officer to be commissioned or whether they join as a private soldier or a ensign, it's a great leveller of life.
It is, definitely. Oh, yes. Says the men out from the boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a certain element, and I could name several, who were called up, and there's only about two or three of them have made through. What, no. Bloody sergeant telling us what to do. They won't do it. They think it's everything's got to come their way. And it doesn't work like that.
Pete, thank you for your time this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and there's a few new stories that you've told me that we didn't pick up when we did the book.
All right.
So, yeah, thank you for your time. I hope you enjoyed it, and thank you very much indeed for your time.
Pleasure.
And to you, our listeners, thank you for joining us. Pete's story takes us from the family farm in Bedfordshire, shaped by a tradition of service through his father's time in the Yeomanry during the First World War and his own service in the Royal Navy during the Second, and then back to a life that he never really left behind. It's a time marked by quiet dedication of spirit and service, both in uniform and at home on the farm. If this story resonated with you, I invite you to explore more episodes of Veterans Voices UK, where we will continue to share the experiences of those who answered the call and served their country with courage and with commitment. These are not simply stories of the past, they're a living legacy. By listening, following, and sharing the podcast, you are helping to ensure that these voices are heard, remembered, and honoured for generations to come. So please follow Veterans Voices UK on your favourite podcast platform. Leave a review and consider sharing this episode with somebody who just may appreciate Pete's remarkable story. And to find out how you can help support the podcast or become involved in future episodes, please visit the website at www.veteransvoices.uk. But most of all, thank you for being part of our community today. We look forward to welcoming you back the next time. Until then, I'm Matt Lim, and this has been a Veterans Voices UK.